Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 122 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, and that is Gavin. And Gavin, have you ever had plans change suddenly?
You know, I sure have.
Like, sometimes that's exciting, and sometimes, like, when you realize the plans are about to change, you're just like, oh, God, this is... The next couple of days of my life are going to be kind of consumed with this sudden change of plans.
Yeah, that also happened to me quite recently, but you can go ahead and talk about yours first if you want.
Just very briefly, as we're recording this, there's, for people that are existing in the world right now, there's some stuff going on in Israel and Palestine and the Gaza Strip. And I teach current events class first thing in the morning tomorrow. I don't even have a planning period or anything. So I got to put in some work to get ready for that class to make sure my kids are up to speed. And frankly, to make sure that I'm up to speed on everything that's going on. And would have been really great if that class wasn't scheduled for 7:30 tomorrow morning. But here we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard... I don't remember what the number was that I heard, but it was at least third, maybe fifth, this is the third or fifth Gaza war since 2007.
Depends on how you mean, what you mean by war, but there's a lot, There has been a number of incursions. Yeah, like every 18 months, seems like.
Yeah. But, yeah, so you were having fun with that.
Yeah, what happened? Yeah, your plans changed at what point?
Yeah, so something that I have not talked about in the podcast up to this point, because, you know, you never know how these things go. Sometimes they fall apart, but Liz and I are closing on a house this Friday.
Yes, I was there when I found when you found out this was a possibility.
Yeah, so, but the change of plans was we thought we were closing on October 30th, and then... We wanted to make sure because that works out like perfect for us for when the first mortgage payment would be due is that it didn't overlap with our rent at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'd have the whole month of November to move our stuff from the apartment to the house.
Right.
And then so we text our, you know, real estate agent. And we're like, hey, just making sure it's still the 30th. Right. And then she took like 3 or 4 days to get back to us. And she was like, nope, you're closing on the 13th. And we were like,
when did that happen?
Okay. Well, our first question was, how does that affect when the first payment's due? and it's still, you know, the same as it was. You have 45 days. So we have now 6 weeks to move out of our apartment and into the house, which is nice. That's like a nice, it gives us all the time we need, which is super nice, especially since getting new utilities set up is really annoying and takes some time. But yeah, so that's some sudden change of plans. So the next time we record this, it might be in the new house. We'll see if we can get the internet and everything set up by then. But yeah.
I'm going to take a bet and say that it won't be ready for the next podcast. We're going to have to wait until podcast after.
You're probably right. Yeah. I've also been meaning to give there's a podcast studio at the library at the university I work at. So I've been meaning to give that a whirl too. So who knows? Maybe that'll be next episode too.
I mean, that'd be incredible if we can say we recorded in a studio.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, so to kind of move things along here because
Mike has some stuff to do. Yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, Lebowski here, some new stuff has come to light.
but yeah, so a quick housekeeping, and then Mike can do a quick Today in History, and we'll get into the meat of the episode. So,
yeah,
do not forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on. Make sure to follow us on our Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, and make sure to give us feedback on the show and any future topics you'd like to hear on the podcast. If you want to be a guest in the show, make sure to fill out the guest form, which we have down below in the show notes, just a simple, easy Google form. And as for next episode, something else that's happening in my life is that in about a week and a half, I am presenting my master's thesis as a talk at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. So I'm finally publishing my master's in some form. So I'm giving a roughly 10 to 12 minute talk about my thesis, which we have an entire episode, like hour-long episode on, so I've got my work cut out for me for cutting it down to 10 minutes. But yeah, so that is, I think, next Friday or Saturday. So yeah, so we're going to be talking about just the conference. It's the first time that I'm ever going to the conference, because this is their big national meeting. It's going to be in Cincinnati, which is pretty neat. So yeah, we're going to be talking all about that. A lot of things, you know, you can't talk about because they're, you know, publishing things have certain copyright stuff. But I'll just talk about my experience and going to a conference and stuff like that.
How many days is that conference?
I get there on the 17th and I leave on the 21st.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a great time. I'm looking forward to hearing all about that.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's one of the few conferences that I haven't been to in some capacity, at least like in my sort of line of work.
Yes, because you've just about done it all.
At least in terms of like the two important ones in paleontology, at least in the U.S., are GSA, the Geological Society of America. And I've been to a ton of, you know, section meetings, never the full one, which is in Pittsburgh this year, but I chose to go to SVP instead because they're like the same week. But yeah, so going to SVP, really excited about it. With that, moving right along, Mike, what happened today?
October 11th, 1975, Lorne Michaels premiered on NBC. Or pardon me, not Lorne Michaels. Saturday Night Live, created by Lorne Michaels.
Yes.
Premiered on NBC for the first time. Do you know who the first host of Saturday Night Live was?
Oh, God. No. 73, you said?
75. Comedian.
75. Comedian. Eddie Murphy?
No.
No, this was before his time.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. No, I do not.
George Carlin.
Interesting. Never would have guessed that.
Big fan of George Carlin. All right. So now that that's all out of the way. Gavin, tell me science stuff.
Yeah. So last episode, we had talked about what this episode was going to be, depending on if Fia was here or not. And as you can hear, you know, our voices are quite deep on this episode. There's not a woman to be found. So we're talking more about humans.
That also says quite a bit about us in addition to Fia, but okay.
Yes. Yeah, we're continuing our talk last episode about humans. So a quick refresher on a bunch of episodes to listen to if you want sort of the full human story. So this would be the order to listen to them in as well. So episode 74, which is about how fish learned to walk. That is how fish evolved legs and came up on land. Episode 35, about early mammals and their relatives, the synapsids. Episode 53, which is sort of mammals after that to about when the dinosaurs went extinct. Episode 86, about primates in general. And then last episode, which is about apes besides humans. So all of our ape-like ancestors. But starting today, we're going to be talking about pretty much just the genus Homo. But yeah, so those roughly 5 hours of our voices get you from fish living in the ocean 360 million years ago to about 3 million years ago when the genus Homo first shows up. And we'll be rounding it off here with our number six in that sort of loose series that we have going on. So last episode left off talking pretty much all about Australopithecus, sort of the genus immediately before our genus Homo. They were the first upright walking apes, and we started just barely to discuss Homo. You get used to hearing that word. We're going to talk about it a lot today.
Which word?
Homo.
There it is, everybody.
Yep. So in many, 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 many episodes of this podcast, I've used the general name for certain groups of different animals. For example, calling all canids dogs, calling all felids cats, calling all bovines cows, etc. Members of the genus Homo are called humans.
All of them?
Full stop. Even the ones that don't really look like us. Not just Homo sapiens. All of us.
Hmm.
There's good reason for that. Because they are much more like us than we tend to give them credit for. And we'll talk about some of those reasons why.
Okay.
When I'm talking specifically about our species, Homo sapiens, I'll either say Homo sapiens, sapiens for short, or call them modern humans. that's typically what they're kind of referred to as. It's just modern humans as Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
So, our setting, about 2.5 million years ago in eastern Africa. Many species of apes, including Australopithecus, Paranthropus, Kenyanthropus, are all walking around upright, looking like Planet of the Apes. From some species of Australopithecus arises the early species of the genus Homo, which is Homo habilis. So a few things differentiate these humans in general, but these early ones from Australopithecus. Firstly, bigger brains. We're going to be talking about what's called encephalization a lot today. That is just your brain getting bigger relative to your overall body size. Mostly in terms of cubic centimeters or cc's. If you ever hear me mention cc's, that's what that means. It's a volume measurement. Some more differences. Humans are what is known as highly pedomorphic, meaning that we retain juvenile traits into adulthood.
Like what?
Adult humans tend to resemble the babies of our ape cousins. Mostly things like big eyes. Our eyes, relative to that of like chimps, are very large, which is tends to be a trait of juvenile animals. Our heads are gigantic compared to the rest of our body, which is typically also pretty common of, baby apes. The general shape of our head, with it being sort of relatively flat in the front, as well as some features of the back of the skull that make it a little less elongated. Less hair, smaller teeth, shorter faces, like I mentioned. All these traits are traits that humans share with juvenile apes, but not adult apes. Some other features that differentiate humans from Australopithecus. More meat in the diet, most likely from scavenging at first, but or also potentially chasing, the actual predators off their prey, coming on like a hyena or something, and just, a whole gaggle of humans coming along and chasing a hyena off something it killed. That's probably how human carnivory started.
Was that necessitated by kind of just like geography conditions, or is it necessitated by like biology, like humans needed that, or at that time, it was just needed for us to, have a different diet?
That's a really excellent question. And that's really highly debated. It's really heavily, it's pretty widely agreed upon that the reason, and we'll talk about this trend throughout this entire episode, is at this point, our brains just start to explode in size. And a big part of that is adding meat to our diet helped fuel that brain growth. As for what brought that on, I didn't really see a ton about it. It might have just been at this point, we were already fairly smart. Our brains were still about the sizes of a chimp, but built kind of differently. So I could definitely see it as like, those things eat meat. What if I did? How would that go? But again, that is just me speculating. I'm sure that there are better answers than that out there, but I didn't really see any, clearly.
We don't have a definitive answer right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is some evidence of Australopithecus eating meat occasionally, but humans generally eat more. And even like chimps will eat meat occasionally. It's by far the minority of their diet. But, they'll chase down smaller monkeys and eat them, semi-frequently, especially like certain populations. That's like part of like their chimp culture is hunting more than other, populations of chimps. It's a really interesting thing to look more into if you have time. Birth in humans is very different than other ape species. Human birth is extra dangerous because of all the changes that we've made to our pelvis to allow us to become bipedal. And that was probably also the case in Australopithecus because of, it had functionally a really similar, pelvis and hip setup to humans. But it's hard to know about soft body, anatomy things, but we have a much better idea about humans because, we are still alive. This weird bipedalism thing, something that I didn't mention about it last episode when I talked about all the advantages and disadvantages of bipedalism, means that you have to have your babies earlier, a little bit undercooked because they physically, it's really hard to run around when you're upright like that, when you also have a baby in you.
Right.
Ask any pregnant woman and they just hurt all the time. So, yeah, so human babies are generally undercooked, like I mentioned. They're not as fully developed as other ape species when they are born. That's why human babies are so basically useless. You know,
right.
They're so helpless compared to a lot of other ape species. Even looking at Australopithecus, we have so many fossils that we have lots of basically infants. And we can tell that, you know, they have, you know, much more robust arms to be able to cling onto their mom. And seemingly, like, right from day one, it kind of seems like they're at least able to hold themselves on their mother without all that much help. Whereas human babies are, you know, for necessity, for, you know, walking upright, and also just the shape of the pelvis kind of messes with the birth canal a little bit. So babies needed to be born, you know, less developed than in a lot of other apes, starting with, you know, late Australopithecus species into Homo habilis. Also, even as babies, humans have ginormous heads. And so that also doesn't help. You know, it still needs to fit through the birth canal. So they need to be born before the head gets too big.
And too fused together.
Yeah. Human babies are born. So if you're laying on your back, a human baby would come out sort of face down on the ground. That is sort of rotated compared to most other animal species. And in order to accommodate this weird birth canal that humans now have, they needed to sort of rotate as they go through the birth canal. It's a little weird to talk about, but again, human birth is just bizarre. Let's see. Also, quick side note, as we're talking about, you know, human reproduction, talking about menopause, apparently that's a thing pretty much only in humans. It does happen to an extent in some other animals, but it's thought that it possibly evolved to set on as early as it does in humans relative to other animals, because it's more beneficial for older women to stop having kids and to help raise their grandkids. That is a more efficient way for them to pass on their genes, because their genes are still in those grandkids. So helping them might have been a more efficient way to pass on genes than continuing to have kids.
And this is just a hypothesis, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So those are, again, just some of the differences. You know, we'll talk about much more as we go on, but between the non-humans and the humans. As I mentioned, earliest human species that we know of is called Homo habilis. Arguably, there's another species in there called Homo rudolfensis, but they might be the same species, so I'm just going to talk about habilis. Mm-hmm. So if you Google Homo habilis, almost certainly one of the first results that will come up will be about tool use. This is the first human ancestor with, like, absolute concrete evidence of this thing made and used tools.
Is there, like, spotty evidence before this?
Yeah. There's some butcher marks on some bones from a little over 3 million years ago. And we're at about 2.5 million years ago. So it's not a huge gap, but it's definitely a gap. Definitely okay. Before any Homo species pop up. We've never found those in, like, association with, like, you know, a stone butcher tool, or we've never found Australopithecus nearby one of these, like, stone butcher tools, but it, and those marks could have been from something else, but it's not, you know, you can't rule out when there is some kind of evidence like that, that Australopithecus might have, you know, one population figured out how to use some tools like this. But for the most part, it's Homo habilis is what most people concretely agree is the first one.
Gotcha.
And that also is, you know, basically everything that Homo habilis is well known for. In fact, its name even means handyman. It's the tool guy. And so it's famous for not just like finding a stick or a rock and using it to accomplish a task, but actually shaping tools to be better at a task, especially stone tools, which they would use to cut meat, cut plants, dig a little bit. And they appear to have, you know, selected specific rocks that would break better in sharp ways, things like obsidian, things like flint, and not just shatter when you hit, you know, one rock on another one, because that's how you do it. You take the big rock that you want to shape and a smaller rock and just kind of hit the smaller rock on the big one to flake away pieces to make it sharp.
Right.
However, it doesn't seem like they had a ton of forethought in them. because
well, I mean, okay, you can't do everything when you're, you know, 3 million years old.
Right. But they didn't seem to hang on to them after they used them. So they would maybe make one and carry it around, use it to cut up an animal or something, or cut some grass, and then just drop it and move on. So not the most forward thinking of creatures. But, you know, it showed that some, you know, they were taught how to do this from one another. This isn't something that just like each one figured out on their own independently.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just the showing of some kind of building of a culture of, hey, here's how you do this. Let me show you that way you can do it. And then you can pass it on to your kids at some point, which is by no means, you know, super unique among animals. You know, elephants teach their young stuff. A lot of birds teach their young stuff. But this is starting to go down the route of the more advanced stuff that humans do.
Right.
Let's see, tool use, like I mentioned, is one of the things that kind of makes us us. That's if you ask people what makes humans humans, that's one of the first things they'll say is tool use. Even though a lot of other animals will pick up a stick and use it, humans are the only ones that really take the stick and then make it into something else.
So should tool use be changed to like something else a bit more concrete?
Probably, but I don't know how else you would phrase that.
Okay.
Yeah, because even like crows are great at using sticks. A lot of birds are. And especially, you know, that's to say nothing of, you know, chimps and some other primates too. Let's see. So that is, you know, Homo habilis's sort of call to fame. A little bit later, around 2 million years ago, we get Homo ergaster and Homo erectus.
Those are two great names.
Yeah. Ergaster is arguably a subspecies of erectus. So again, we'll just be going with erectus for the most part. Homo erectus. Yeah. Homo erectus is around for a really long time.
Can I assume it's Homo erectus because it like stands up and down and like that's where the erect part comes from?
Yes.
Okay.
To my knowledge, we don't have any of their soft body anatomy.
Well done, Gavin. Well played.
That's the science terminology coming out, folks. So Homo erectus is around.
So many other jokes I want to make right now.
I mean, we're going to be talking about Homo erectus for a little bit here. So
okay,
hold it in, buddy. Yeah. So
can't just throw me a softball like that.
Whatever. So. Yeah, as a species, Homo erectus is around for a long time in terms of human evolution. So it's around from about 2 million years ago to only about 100,000 years ago, which in the grand scheme of things is basically yesterday.
You said 2 million to 100,000?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a rather significant chunk of time.
Yeah. And so this was the first of our immediate cousins to make it outside of Africa. More on that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
So Homo erectus comes along with a lot of new features. Homo erectus's body is basically the size of a modern human from the neck down, functionally the same body. Some differences here and there, but you have to really know what you're doing to be able to say that's not a Homo sapiens. If you were just looking at a skeleton from like the shoulders down.
Okay.
much more importantly than the rest of the body, this is really where the brain starts turning into a balloon. Homo habilis, like I mentioned, had a brain about the same size as a chimpanzee still. All the way through Australopithecus and everything, it stayed more or less the same. The structure of it changed quite a bit, but the size and just like number of neurons, more or less pretty stable. Homo erectus comes along and totally changes that by nearly doubling the brain size of Homo habilis from around 600 cc's to a little over 1,000 cc's. And that's just the average. The range is quite large compared to modern humans, for example. So there were definitely, even within the same species, even with the same populations and sort of regional areas, the brain size would vary quite a bit from individual to individual, where we don't really see that much in Homo sapiens.
Okay. Does it like based on age, based on sex, based on, do we know why it varies?
A bit based on sex, mostly just because males are bigger. But no, it could have just been this one was able to get more food when it was growing up, maybe even just like a weird genetic difference, because even in, you know, areas that today that have, you know, pretty severe malnutrition in certain parts of Africa and certain parts of like India or other places, or even here in the US, honestly, lack of nutrition doesn't really do much to brain size.
Okay.
It can do things to like cognition over time and you know, problem solving and things like that, but brain size, it doesn't really have that much of an effect on.
Understood.
Definitely not to show the range that we see in these species here. This brain size over increase over such a short period of time, I saw somebody did out the math and it was quite helpful, would roughly equal out to each generation gaining about 125,000 neurons compared to their parents.
I mean, that seems like a lot just over time.
Right. And it's like, in the context, adult modern humans have about 10 billion neurons. So 125,000 doesn't seem like a lot, but...
But if it's each generation.
Right. And so... It would only take 8 generations to gain 1 million neurons, 1 million with an M. And in modern humans, that takes about 200 years, give or take, to go through 8 generations. However, because their babies were more developed than ours and had a shorter childhood, they probably reproduced more quickly. And so they likely got through that much faster, that same 8 generations. So they were just... really, really investing in the brain evolutionarily at this point, a lot. This bump in brain power led to better tool use and tool craftsmanship. They created these really sharp hand axes that more or less kind of look like a larger, wider stone arrowhead that fits pretty nicely in like the palm of your hand. And they would use this, you know, to butcher animals, cut branches or other plants, and to dig in the ground for roots and stuff to eat. And it was clear these were much more advanced than those made by Homo habilis. And they also seemed to hang on to them much longer. And they were much less crude and much clearer that they were making like a point, and also making sharp edges like along each side of the point, like an arrowhead or something. And like I said, there's evidence of them lasting a lot longer, of them sort of resharpening them once they got dull. So definitely sort of more forward thinking, like, hey, I might need this later. I should probably hang on to this. Even more impressive than the tools, though, is Homo erectus's use of fire. We are finally at the point where man invents fire.
I was saying, this is not just like coincidental, there's like fire somewhere in the earth, but there's evidence of like actual thought behind this. Okay.
Yeah. At first, it pretty much just seems like, you know, hey, there's like a brush fire or something. I'm going to take this stick that's on fire and bring it back to my cave and throw some more sticks on it and keep it burning. you know, not creating the fire themselves, but being able to be like, hey, when the grass all burns, all the animals run away from it. I would like those animals to run away from me, please. Maybe I take the fire. And so the first evidence of actual controlled use of fire is about 1.5 million years ago in some caves in South Africa. That is likely this taking fire from a natural source, bringing it back to your cave, and continuing it at least for some length of time. However, it's pretty spotty for quite a while after that. Much more concrete evidence of things like hearths show up somewhere between 800,000 and 400,000 years ago in northern Africa and up through sort of the Middle East. And it's to the point where it's even speculated that fire was invented and then lost several times all around Africa and the Middle East region.
I can believe that.
Yeah. You know, the one guy in your group that figures out how to rub some sticks together just right catches himself on fire, and you're like, well,
yep,
guess I don't know how to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in my humble opinion, fire is arguably the most important thing to ever happen to human civilization.
Why?
So the most obvious reason is that it lets you cook your food, which, mm-hmm. especially at this point in time when brains were growing so fast, cooking food makes it easier to absorb the nutrients in it, and also just safer to eat in the case of things like meat. There's a reason we cook our meat. So it's not just for safety, but because the fire sort of breaks down a lot of the proteins into their base amino acids and stuff, that's a lot easier for your stomach to just absorb, and it makes your stomach have to do less work. So you're getting more nutrients for less energy spent digesting it.
Yeah, okay.
It also helps, especially with plants. You know, plants are not very easily digestible. And cooking them, just think of things like carrots or potatoes, how they're so crunchy and tough and hard when they're not cooked, but they're nice and chewy or at least much softer when they are cooked.
Right. A lot of potatoes. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Fire also, like I mentioned, wards off predators at night and helps keep, you know, groups of people safe. But the reason I think is most important thing that we've ever created is that it allows for us to sort of connect with one another in ways that they kind of didn't have before. Most apes are only awake from sunup to sundown, and modern humans are typically awake for about 16 hours, quite a while after sundown, even in areas with sort of little technology or, you know, bright phone screens to keep them awake, like happens to me every night. They could stay up around fires and talk. And it's sort of hypothesized that hanging out around campfires is sort of what allowed, or at least helped, language to first evolve. Because by this point, you know, they might have been able to, you know, draw crude pictures in like the dirt to be able to talk to one another or point at stuff, but they didn't have, there was no language up to this point, even in the human species. You know, we know that they probably couldn't speak as well as we can. Their like throat anatomy didn't really allow for it. But this is hypothesized that, you know, they're you know, hanging out in a relatively low stress place, and it sort of lets you just sort of be with each other.
Is there evidence of that, or is that just a hypothesis?
That's just hypothesized.
Okay. I mean, it makes some amount of sense, but I'm always curious, like...
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Just what... Yeah, right. Why do we think the things that we do when it comes to, like, human sociology?
Yeah. And also, this part is completely anecdotal. There's just something about, like, a big fire that just kind of, like, stirs something inside of you.
Yeah, of course.
And this immediately, reading about all of this made me immediately think of the fires we used to have at Hobie. this was, you know, back when we were still in, you know, the location where Mike and I attended. For anybody who doesn't know, Hobie is sort of the volunteerism youth leadership organization where Mike and I first met and how we know a lot of our, you know, really good friends through. And before our insurance told us we couldn't do it anymore, we used to have these giant bonfires. And our friend Mark would regale the students about how culturally important fire is and would tell this, you know, story around the fire. And it, in my opinion, that was always the part that sort of brought the weekend together for all the kids.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And a lot of my favorite Hobie memories come from around that fire as well. And that just was something that personally just made me, when I was sort of doing the research here, made me think about that a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of nice.
Yeah. And then lastly, on fire. Fire likely allowed Homo erectus to spread all around the world like it did. You know, it got out of Africa before fire became super widespread, but it was also toward the end of this time in the, you know, 800,000 to 400,000 or so years ago, where the Ice Age really started to sort of kick in. And so we find lots of Homo erectus fossils around Europe. And these areas would have been quite cold if you didn't have some kind of source of heat. So yeah, that's all I'm going to say about fire here for a little bit. But lastly, moving on through Homo erectus, it was the first of our immediate ancestors, like I said earlier, sort of asterisk here, to leave Africa. It headed first through the Middle East into Asia, because that was likely because that was more hospitable climates, not quite as cold, even though they did have to cross the desert. It wasn't quite as deserty as it is today. And then eventually northward into Europe. This happened in multiple waves over many thousands of years, and we can tell that because when we see these different innovations showing up in each place, you know, when fire became commonplace different places, when these different varieties of stone tools kind of showed up, we can tell that they left Africa with these innovations multiple times. Homo erectus also was known to build some kinds of crude houses made out of plants. As early as 1.75 million years ago, but became much more common around 400,000 years ago. Seems likely that they also had clothing in some form, as we see some tools made specifically for scraping animal skin as early as about 700,000 years ago. So some kind of clothing and shelter at this point as well. Yeah, this is all seeming, as I mentioned earlier, we don't give these guys enough credit. Where we think of clothes and houses as things that we do, it's like, no, we've been doing that for a really long time.
Yeah, how far back was this again?
Depending on which one you're looking at, crude dwellings as early as 1.75 million years ago. But for sure, you know, in the sub-million time frame. And then clothes, at potentially as early as 700,000 years ago, an asterisk on that, because like we found the tools, we haven't found the clothes.
So, but still, we're talking about like hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Yes.
Like, yeah, okay.
Close to a million potentially.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. Homo erectus also, this one confused me a lot, seems also to have been at least somewhat capable of surviving sea voyages. Whether those voyages were intentional or not is up for debate. I would lean towards probably not. But we see their tools on islands that have not been connected to the land in multiple millions of years. So we know that, you know, they couldn't have walked there even when sea levels were lower during the Ice Age. Especially some islands in like the Indo-Pacific where there's like trenches between some of these islands. So they've been islands for a really long time, but yet we find Homo erectus tools on these islands. So how they all got there, unsure. It's not like we think they were building boats, so I don't really know how they're proposed to have, you know, made their way there. Probably similar to, as we've mentioned a handful of times, during big storms, sometimes, usually generally smaller animals will get washed out on, you know, floating rafts of vegetation and stuff. I would find that kind of hard to believe with an animal this size, but, you know, stranger things have happened, I guess. We could go on and on and on more about Homo erectus, because it really is the first one to really, that you would look at and watch doing stuff and you would call it a human from, you know, a modern human perspective.
Right. Like, it's just a generic, like, it, somebody that didn't know what they were talking about, be like, yeah, that looks pretty human-y.
Right. And as we'll talk about, you know, toward the end of the episode here in a little bit, Neanderthals are typically what most people refer to as cavemen. But really, I feel like just like technology-wise, it is much more like Homo erectus to be sort of that more crude stone tools living in caves kind of lifestyle. And as we'll talk about, not nearly as much for Neanderthals, or Neanderthals, as depending on how you pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we can go on and on and on about how big of a step Homo erectus was, including, among other things, clear evidence of taking care of their sick, potentially the earliest evidence of their art, but we have some other stuff to talk about, so we're going to move on. Because Homo erectus was able to spread all around the world, it was real easy for populations to become isolated from one another and become new species. So Homo erectus sprouts off into a whole bunch of other species of Homo. We'll talk about a couple just real quick before we sort of, these are ones that are not directly related to us. These following ones didn't become us, just sort of our weird cousins that show up to family reunions sometimes. The first one is Homo floresiensis, which is a species of island dwarf human from the island of Flores in Indonesia. Yeah, just like we've talked about before, with dwarf elephants in the elephants episode, sometimes when large animals get to islands, they become not large because there's not enough resources to sustain such a large body. And this happened with humans as well.
Right.
These guys were about 3.5 feet tall and between 50 and 60 pounds. Yeah, there are several skeletons, so it's not like it's just one where we can be like, I wonder if this one just had like a genetic dwarfism condition like we see today. But no, there are multiple of them. And so it seems like this is just a species that had to become smaller because they were on an island. This may have been descended from very early populations of Homo erectus, but there aren't any Homo erectus fossils known from sort of this area of the world at the same time we find floresiensis. So it's like we can't find the route they took to get there if it is Homo, or if they came from Homo erectus. It may have been a group earlier like Homo habilis, or potentially even a really advanced species of Australopithecus. This is sort of that asterisk that I mentioned with Homo erectus being the first one to leave Africa. We don't really know super where Homo floresiensis came from, but based on when we see it, it must have been earlier than we think Homo erectus left Africa.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah. These guys are kind of a mystery. We don't have a ton of them. But yeah, so these guys were around from about 1 million years ago until just 50,000 years ago. The blink of an eye, realistically. And then the other one I'm going to talk about real quick, that's not really related to us, is Homo antecessor, which is a species from Spain at around the 1 million years ago mark. It was once thought that this was the most recent common ancestor between us and Neanderthals, but genetics has kind of since said no to that. Now it kind of just seems like another offshoot of Homo erectus. I only bring it up because if you look up, you know, common ancestor of humans and Neanderthals, this might come up, but just know that's not really what people think anymore. And our last sort of offshoot we're going to talk about right here is Homo heidelbergensis. This species is kind of weird taxonomically, so meaning we don't really know how to name all the different populations and stuff. This species could be one species that ranges all the way from southern Africa to northern Europe to East Asia. So the entire old world. Or it could be a handful of species broken up into different regions. For simplicity's sake, we're just going to call it the one, Homo heidelbergensis.
Okay.
Now we're starting to get the head looking much more like a modern human. The body has been since, you know, Homo erectus, even pretty early Homo erectus populations, like I said, the body looked very human-like. At this point, sort of the head is becoming much more human. Had a very flat face, like modern humans. Brains jump up again in size, about 20%, from about 1,000 cc's to close to 1,200 cc's, which is, give or take, the range of modern humans. So by this point, same size, vaguely similar face. Some of the facial features, like the eyebrows, the nose, the chin, were different. But the brain and sort of the rest of the skull looks basically the same as us. Again, we see an advancement in tools, this time with wooden spears being associated with these guys. So they were not just making their rocks. They were taking those rocks and then being like, hey, this stick, I bet I can make this pretty sharp too, using the rock. And so this allowed them to be able to take on much, much larger prey animals. This is basically when we start taking down elephants and mammoths and stuff. Shelter structures, much more common and generally a bit more complex than in Homo erectus. We have some more convincing art in the form of some potential beads, like necklace beads made from sponge fossils that have been associated with this species. Some very loose evidence of burying the dead, which is a huge deal if that is true.
There's something advanced about that.
Yeah. That just kind of shows more coordination, or at least an understanding of, if it's not some kind of cultural or religious thing, it at least is like, hey, things eat dead stuff and I don't want those things near me. I should get rid of this dead guy.
Right.
Likely had, at least anatomically, the same speech capabilities as modern humans. No way of really knowing if they had some form of spoken language, but at least their throat anatomy wasn't stopping them from doing it like it was in Homo erectus. They had all the same at least similar enough vocal cords and tongue muscles and stuff to be able to speak like modern humans do.
Mm-hmm.
And this species is likely where we and our closest relatives come from. And we're going to end off the episode here, talk about three different species all at the same time.
Let's do it.
Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, and the Denisovans. We'll talk more about
the different name.
Yeah, we'll talk about more about that in just a second. So, arguably, these are three species. Arguably, these are one species with three subspecies. And technically, officially, the Denisovans are not a species anyway. We'll talk about it. Genetic studies suggest that sapiens and Neanderthals split somewhere around 800,000 years ago. But the oldest Neanderthal bones are around 430,000 years ago. So there's quite a big gap there where we should have Neanderthal bones, but we don't. Unsure of exactly why, but we just kind of don't have them. And it's not until around 130,000 years ago that Neanderthals become much, much more common. Pretty much all of the Neanderthal fossils we have are more recent than 130,000 years. Neanderthals split from Homo heidelbergensis, some population of heidelbergensis in Europe, and a bit into the Middle East and Asia, but mostly Europe, while Homo sapiens split off from some population of heidelbergensis somewhere in Africa. Due to colder climates, Neanderthals were generally more robust than sapiens. They had thicker bones, shorter limbs, which helped conserve heat. Because as you've noticed, you know, if you live in a place that gets cold, the first thing to get real cold are your hands and feet, because your body, that's the first place that heat leaves from. So if you have shorter, smaller limbs, that helps you keep your heat, you know, in your chest area and around your organs where you really need it. And contrary to most of the popular belief you'll see out there, Neanderthals had significantly larger brains than Homo sapiens.
So why didn't these guys make it and we did?
That is a wonderful question, and we don't really know. It could be that we just had more population to start with. It never seemed like Neanderthals had a high population, and especially not high population density. They just lived in really fragmented populations, so it's possible that they didn't have enough genetic diversity to be able to sustain like a good breeding population. The climate was doing all sorts of funky, weird things all the time. And because they were so cold adapted, maybe like a prolonged warming period made it so Homo sapiens did better than they did at certain times. It's kind of hard to say.
Okay.
But as we'll talk about, they only kind of went extinct. They mostly went extinct, but only kind of.
Oh, okay.
Also the bigger brains thing is also a slight, you know, misnomer, because they were just bigger than us. So it makes sense to have larger brains, but their brains were about 30% bigger, and they were not 30% bigger than us. Again, likely had all the same speech characteristics that we do. So they probably had forms of language as well. They for sure had clothes, fairly sophisticated clothes, in order to live in, you know, Northern Europe during the Ice Age. They had almost all of the same features that we do, and they were smart, just like us. They made jewelry, they made wall scratching art, potentially even music from bone flutes that have been
awesome.
Yeah, potentially associated with them. That part's kind of up for, you know, under a lot of scrutiny. But, you know, it's something that's like, I wouldn't put it past them, but the evidence seems a little shaky, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They lived a really mobile lifestyle, following prey as the seasons changed, mostly living in caves. So, you know, they decided it wasn't as worth it to build shelters as often as some other species did. But they did occasionally do it, mostly to set up like a little hunting camp, essentially. Where if they were able to kill something really big, they'd set up a shelter around it so they didn't have to haul it all the way back to their cave. Let's see. We know that Neanderthals, like I said, must have had clothing, and like I said, pretty sophisticated clothing, but that doesn't really preserve, because you're taking away all the hard parts and stuff from the animal when you just take its skin. All that to say, Neanderthals were basically just like us, that were just a little shorter, a little stockier, and lived in colder places. That's the only difference between us and Neanderthals, really. The other group I mentioned, the Denisovans.
Yeah, what's up with them?
They likely were also just like us. However, unlike Homo sapiens or Homo neanderthalensis, the Denisovans did not leave us much to work with regarding fossils. We mostly know of the Denisovans from a small handful of teeth and finger bones found in Denisova Cave in Russia. So a single cave that was found in sort of the late, you know, 2000s, 2008, 2010 or so. And so because, you know, genetic stuff was just starting to really come online with like high fidelity at that time, some genetic tests were done on these and revealed that it's probably a new species. It's not Neanderthal. It's not Homo sapiens. It's genetically really close, but it's definitely not either. But you're not allowed to name a new species off of just DNA.
Yeah, what else does it need? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, you need a good enough fossil that when you find other fossils, you can compare them to and be like, is this the same or is it different? So ideally, a skull would be basically would be perfect in this case, because functionally our post-crania, you know, everything but the skull is very, very similar. So you really would need skulls to be able to, you know, confidently name a new species off of the, you know, from the Denisovans.
And we don't have that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Since then, we found a handful of other Denisovan specimens in some caves in China and Laos. So it seems like they were just kind of kicking around, you know, Northern Asia all the way down to, you know, Southern Asia in Laos. Laos is a very different place than Siberia, which is where Denisova Cave is.
One might say, yeah.
Very different environments. So they clearly were pretty adaptable. We just don't know almost anything about them. And so the reason to talk about Neanderthals, Denisovans, and us together is because we sure spent a whole heck of a lot of time together. All three of these species interbred quite a lot.
Okay.
And
it was similar enough, I can see it.
Yes, and produced offspring. You know, there's one Homo sapiens specimen from about 40,000 years ago who was 11% about Neanderthal. Meaning that just a couple generations ago, one of her, you know, great-great-great-grandparents was a Neanderthal, plus some, like, smattering of, you know, like, her mom being, you know, 8% or 2 Neanderthal. So that shows that, like, over many generations, this happened multiple times. Basically, today, non-African people have about 1 to 2% Neanderthal DNA. And so another hypothesis is that we basically absorbed the Neanderthal population into our own as we moved through Europe and then Asia and then did the same thing with the Denisovans.
And so is that what you mean when you say they like mostly went extinct, but like still right. 1 to 2% continue on?
Right.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that, you know, 1 or 2% of people are pure Neanderthal. That's, you know, not how math works. You know, it's not like if you have 100 people in a room, one of them's a Neanderthal. yeah. No, it's just certain genes, particularly, like I said, in northern regions, particularly in Europe, are much more common. And in fact, some of them are unique to Neanderthals. So we know that we interbred with them quite a lot. And still carry on a lot of their DNA to this day. So they're only kind of extinct on paper.
And for all like practical purposes.
Well, yeah. But obviously both the Neanderthals go extinct and the Denisovans, we don't really know what happens to them. it's kind of thought that maybe some of the native peoples of like the Himalayas have some genes that are more closely associated with the Denisovans and that they might be obviously not a different species than Homo sapiens, obviously, but, you know, have some of their traits that are, that they may have gotten from the Denisovans, but it's really hard to tell. But.
And that's where we're going to leave it.
That kind of just leaves it. Yeah. That kind of just leaves it with Homo sapiens. That being said, we have continued to evolve so much since Homo sapiens first showed up in, you know, southeastern Africa, including having lighter skin. Even the European populations of Homo sapiens, based on the genetics, kind of seem like they've only had pale skin for the last couple thousand years, even though Homo sapiens has been in Europe for, you know, tens and tens of thousands of years. So that might have been a way that Neanderthals and humans, you know, could tell each other apart, was that humans just had darker skin at the time. And, you know, definitely not any, you know, lighter hair colors. That was definitely something that kind of came about in the last only handful of thousands of years.
No kidding. Really?
Yeah. Other things like lactase persistence, which is what allows adults to drink milk. That is a relatively new adaptation, also only in the last couple thousand years, because we started, you know, milking cows, domesticated cows. But yeah, also modern Homo sapiens are quite a lot larger than the early Homo sapiens. You know, I would have been Andre the Giant. Mike or I would have been Andre the Giant to the early Homo sapiens, because we are, you know, a little bit over 6 feet tall. And that would have been on the extreme high end for, you know, the average Homo sapiens at the time. So all to say, humans are not done evolving. Clearly, we've kind of taken ourselves out of natural selection, but that doesn't mean that evolution itself doesn't happen. And that can be the topic of a future episode at some point, too. But now we're on like page 6 of notes. So I feel like I should wrap all of this up by saying we have been humans for a long time. The things that we think of that make us human are not exclusive to us. We're part of a really long line of all of these different species from all over the world doing these things and learning these things together. And I think that's pretty special.
I feel like that's something, like, I've heard that before when someone who was really high in college was making something like that. We're all connected, man. Like, yeah. But no, that is a great note to end things on, and a wonderful end to the two-parter that we've had here. This has been episode 122 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, that's Gavin, and we'll see everybody in 2 weeks. Take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Finella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.